Welcome back to 77 Degrees South. In this episode, the inspiring explorers reach the heart of iconic explorer Sir Ernest Shackleton at Cape Royds, and they continue careful preparations for the return of a historic artifact carried all the way from Aotearoa, New Zealand to Discovery Hut. Between wildlife sightings and landings, the inspiring explorers were preparing for a hopeful landing at Hut Point, where we planned to return a historic artifact back to Scott's Discovery Hut. The artifact is a worn copy of The Count of Monte Cristo, a novel written in 1846 by Alexandre Dumas, with soot-blackened pages and its cover missing. Maya talked to Louise and Daniel about the preparations to return the artifact.
What have you guys been doing to, you know, keep the book safe on this journey? I know you've been tag-teaming the responsibility.
Well, back in December, Lizzie, who's the trust lead conservator, we worked together to pack the book in a way that kind of met, I suppose, you know, good conservation packing standards. So we use a combination of foam and Tyvek in a nice little waterproof box that's the right size for it. And then that's living inside a larger pelican-style case, which has more foam packaging. So it's now, you know, very stable. It's very well padded. It's waterproof. So it's been able to, so far, it's been able to survive a journey on the plane from Christchurch to Queenstown. And then it's gone on a bus from Queenstown to Bluff. And now, you know, it's sailing on its way back home to the icy continent.
Is there some anticipation of, like, finally getting to the point where we might be able to return it?
Yeah, it's kind of surreal, I guess. You know, we're on this boat and it feels, you know, it's very nice, and the boat has fantastic stabilization, and it feels strange to be in these waters that these, like, heroic era explorers were in, but in this kind of entirely different environment. You know, it's not as harsh, and it's, you know, we're not feeling that swell as much, but also just looking out over the ocean and the vastness of it and realizing how far we're kind of venturing to return this object. It's pretty surreal.
I will say as well, as a museum professional, you know, we're always packing things to go out on loan or to travel into, even just to go to the gallery, whatever it might be. And so we're always thinking about different ways to pack something, different ways that we can kind of mitigate any sort of damage that might happen during transport, because that's often when damage does occur. And so this is a really fantastic kind of test of our skills, you know, to take an artifact that's so important and pack it in such a way that we can really, for want of a better word, just throw it around into our backpacks, jump on a Zodiac, you know, land. Like, at the end of the day, all things considered, safety is going to come first. So, you know, some of these landings can be a little bit choppy, and some of the landings that we have had, where we're kind of jumping out of a boat into reasonable swells, you know, you really have to think about packing for that. And it's a really fun test of kind of our skills here.
Yeah.
Why does this belong in Antarctica? Why go to all of these lengths to bring it back to the hut?
It's of interpretive value, let's say, to the hut as it is, and I think it's a really important part of the hut's story. And so to be able to put it back on the ice, and of course there are lots of arguments about what's the best way to kind of preserve these artifacts, and for a long time it was bring them home just because there were so few people that were going to Antarctica. But now things are a little bit different, you know, with the internet and with virtual reality and the kind of experiences that you can get, there are ways that we can experience the huts in sort of a really authentic way, where they still have interpretive value even if you can't actually get to Antarctica. And I think that's more of a reason to keep things as sort of authentic as possible, if that's a problematic term, but keep things as close as possible to sort of their best interpretive value in their original location. I think that's a great value, you know, in an age of surrogation, where you can really tell stories away from the sort of initial location. It kind of lends more authenticity or more sort of gravity to those stories if you can maintain an original setting as much as possible. And I think that book is a really important part of that, and tells a story that perhaps no other object in that hut tells, or a part of that story rather. And for that reason, it's really, I think it's really fantastic that we can put that object back in that hut.
I suppose what really makes it so unique is that in our jobs, you know, many things come across our paths and we, you know, do our best to stabilize them, but it's so rare to to do the work on it and then to take it back to where it's actually from, because these environments where, you know, that are almost frozen time are actually so rare, and so many things are in museums because their original environments have been lost, or, you know, they've changed over the course of time. And so to be a part of this experience, it's incredibly unique, and I think it's actually what really drew me to being part of this expedition, was the involvement with, you know, being able to, I guess, connect to these objects and then be in the space and be in that environment that's really so immersive, and where you can really feel the weight of this space and the experiences that people had there. And so to be able to take this item of leisure that is so recognisable to everybody in the world as this, you know, this pastime, it provides us just amazing connection to the past.
I think it really speaks to the kind of work that the Trust are doing in conserving these huts, that, you know, here's an object that we can say, as I indicated earlier, that basically we can say for certain that we would no longer have this object if it was not taken off the ice. That environment originally was not a safe environment for that object to sit in. And the fact that we can now return that to that same environment and know that it is very likely to be fine, you know, in perpetuity, really is shows just how important the work is that they're doing.
The preservation of Antarctica's species in pristine environments means biosecurity is crucially important, especially with the threat of bird flu making its way around wild bird populations the world over. Before landing in Antarctica and between each sub-Antarctic island, there is a rigorous process of cleaning, all to stop introduced species making their way into these untouched environments. Let's see how Jake was preparing.
Can you explain to me what you're getting organised to do?
Right, so we are getting gear ready for the biosecurity check, and we do that because we don't want to introduce any unwanted or non-native species to the Antarctic lands, which we're about to go and wander around on. The first step in the process is we're going to get all of our outer layers that we're going to wear on the continent and take them to be inspected. And we're looking for things like seeds, which seem to love finding their way into Velcro and into the little nooks and crannies in the bottom of pockets and into seams if they're not sealed properly. And we'll also be looking for any visible dirt, any marking, anything which would suggest that the items are not perfectly clean. And that is just exclusively so we can make sure that we don't introduce any disease or unwanted pests or wildlife to the continent. It's a pretty intense process, and for very good reason. And so we're going to grab our stuff now and head upstairs to have it all inspected, checked, vacuumed to make sure there's no little hidden bits inside pockets, and give it a good scrub and dip it into a chemical solution which kills any life forms which may be trying to cling their way in there on the bottom of boots or other bits and bobs which touch the ground.
Shackleton got a taste of the polar environment on Scott's Discovery expedition and was determined to return. Following years of groundwork, the Nimrod departed from its final port of Lyttelton in 1908, heavily laden with ponies, dogs, and even a motor car. After much frustration with sea ice, Shackleton established a base at Cape Royds, the third hut to be built in the Ross Sea region. This expedition marked many firsts: the first ascent of Mount Erebus, the first book written and printed in Antarctica, the Aurora Australis, and reaching the furthest south any human had ever been. Shackleton made it to within 97 nautical miles, or 180 kilometres, of the South Pole, but decided to turn around, putting the welfare of his men ahead of the possible glory, later remarking to his wife, "I thought you'd rather have a live donkey than a dead lion." The feelings of goodwill and protection associated with this decision extend to the hut. The windows illuminate the interior with a soft glow, and the stove sits in the centre of the room, as if ready to boil the kettle at any moment. The hut also guards a secret stash of leftover whiskey, excavated by conservators in 2010 and replicated in Scotland by the same company who developed the original tipple over 100 years ago.
We'd already had our first glimpse of Shackleton's hut at Cape Royds, sailing past 2 days earlier and finding the bay full of rotten sea ice. When we returned, Antarctica had shown us once again who was boss, with the ice entirely blown out of the bay. We landed early in the morning and trekked over flat, fast ice to get to land at Cape Royds. There, on a uniquely serene day for the Cape, we discovered Shackleton's hut, safely tucked into a fold in the landscape. We've just left the ASPA, the Antarctica Specially Protected Area, at Cape Royds, where Shackleton's hut is from his 1907 to 1909 expedition. I'm standing outside with Billy Kitsiona. Okay, what did you make of that? What did you think?
Like, it was just amazing. As soon as you enter, like, you're warm. Like, you get this warm feeling that they're still here. Like, you still feel like they're still here, but, like, yeah. And getting to see it in real life is just magnificent.
Did you see, did you put your head into Shackleton's little bed corner? What did you think of that one?
I can't believe he has his own, like, private room, but I heard that he shares. He's, like, a good leader, a good role model.
Let's meet Jake near a small Adélie penguin colony behind Shackleton's hut.
Ah, there is a chick. It's like a... So we're walking around the lake and we just spotted a little chick. I mean, it must be a, is it a skua chick? I think it's a skua chick.
It
looks like the one we saw when we landed at Gondwana Station. It's just like a fluff ball.
But this one's much farther away, maybe 20 metres.
Yeah.
Or more, which is good. Give it
and
space.
It's just hanging out. It's... And you got to think, it was about minus 22 degrees yesterday with wind chill. If you're going to be a baby here, you want to be pretty fluffy and insulated to get through it. So it's about the fluffiest kind of thing you can imagine. And it's just hanging out. Yeah. We've got our on-field reporter, Louise, here.
It's a beautiful day here at Cape Royds. We're hanging out by the lakes, enjoying the penguins. And desperately hoping for Mount Erebus to peek its way through the clouds that are currently covering it. It's just like a standard day in Tongariro
National Park. It's pretty rocky. It's, as Billy said before, it's kind of like walking on the moon. It's very volcanic. It's very fine. It's sort of gravelly and ashy. There's a little mummified penguin chick here.
That's a skua, actually.
Mummified skua chick. It's a remarkable environment. I mean, I think it's when you come to somewhere so untouched as this that you really begin to understand how much we kind of, you know, shape our environments, particularly our urban environments, into kind of what we want them to be or what we're used to having. This is, you know, as Maya said, sort of covered in bones and feathers and mummified chicks and rocks everywhere, and it is... It's unique, I guess, in that it's inhospitable. And I guess a big part of it as well, come to think of it, is that there's no plant life. It's just desolate. There's sort of no greenery, shrubbery. There's nothing. There's just rocks. Rocks and signs of bird life and bird death.
Back on the ship and warmed up with hot tea and blankets, Maya talked with Daniel and Nawai about the journey to get to step inside the door of Shackleton's Nimrod Hut.
Yeah, it was really nice today that we managed to land at Cape Royds, because when we went past, it was only, I think, 2 days ago, and there was sea ice coming out for a very long distance from the shore, and there was no chance of us landing. And we weren't even that sure that we'd be able to land on this trip, but it just changes so quickly. So just in the couple of days there, we had still the sort of the main landing at Cape Royds still was inaccessible due to the sea ice, but we had a lot of the ice move out of Backdoor Bay, which is kind of the you know, one of the other spots that you can land, and so we had a lot of that ice come out, and even in the time that we went in, you know, when we kind of went on in the Zodiacs, we were able to kind of work through like a little bit of a channel through the ice, and by the time we came off a couple of hours later, it was just a completely clear run to the ship. But we did land actually on the sea ice.
We've spoken a lot about feeling with all the other huts and the feeling that we got when we walked inside and the impressions. What were the feelings that you guys had, the impressions when you walked inside?
For me personally, every single hut that we have walked into, I've felt an immense amount of Waitawa, just spirit. it just hits you in the chest. And going into that hut today, it felt different from, you know, our previous huts that we had visited. And I think the reason is because this was a successful trip for them and this was not death in that hut. So, you know, feeling that tapu and that sacred, it brought my mood up a lot more. And when I felt that spirit, I was able to just close my eyes and feel the moment and envision these men's journey. And for me, that was a really beautiful process to be able to go through. And I went outside and I did a karakia, or a prayer, just to thank the ancestors, the Tupuna and Shackleton, for doing this amazing voyage over to this hut and leaving the key on the door, you know, for the future generations and hospitality and manaakitanga. It was really special. I felt like I really connected with that hut today.
It was interesting. This hut had a really different feeling to the other huts, and it's often said that this is kind of the coziest of the huts,
I
think.
It was. Cozy.
I think it was so the socks cozy. Hanging above my head for me that made it cozy. Yeah.
But the actual interior of this hut is really different. So the other huts were really quite, I suppose, Borchgrevink's hut really was a tiny hut. It was really small, so there wasn't much, and it felt cramped for that reason. Mm. And just even the way the bunks were laid out, like
not
it was
homely.
It wasn't homely. And of course, there's no objects in there, so there's nothing in there to kind of warm that space really. Just a few kind of just the bunks themselves, the pictures on the bunks, and you know a few odds and ends that couldn't be kind of removed for conservation. But Cape Evans, of course, is full and complete, but that hut is kind of, I think, just because it's quite a big space, but there are quite a lot of people were in there, and they've really divided up the space, and it's very kind of, you know, regimented in the way that it's kind of, they've really carved it up, and they've made really good use of the space. But this hut, as you walk in, it feels really wide and open. There's a lot of it's a really kind of open plan, and it's a much smaller hut, but there are kind of much fewer bunks, so there are only what, 4 or 5 bunks out at the moment. And they did have some that kind of folded down, and also the table that they ate at kind of was suspended from the ceiling, so that actually like was supposed to come down, so the space where that would take up was completely clear. Whereas in the other huts, of course, they had benches and things down the center. This hut as well, they don't have quite as many artifacts from it. And I think it was at different times, it was a little bit emptier. And so they've kind of, the artifacts that they do have, they've sort of spread out really nicely so that they fill the space. It still feels really lived in and feels very genuine and authentic and still has that feeling. But it doesn't have that clutter maybe that the other ones have. And just as a result of that, as you walk in, you really felt that sense of space, like it was a really beautiful space as you walk in, and everything in there was just really kind of really lovely, like it really felt like you know, this kind of vignette, or just this really cozy space, and you could really see yourself living in it. I think
I feel like going into that hut as well, it felt really homely and really cozy because of the big stove. That was like a really big monumental object. The Mrs. Sam stove, like, was really big, and I could, you know, like looking at it, I could envision them, like, you know, boiling their water to have their tea, and you know, cooking their little food over here and over there, and going into the little wee kitchen as well, you know, seeing that all come together. Like, it was a really nice layout, and it felt really welcoming, really homely. And because I felt that, it was good to envision, you know, the life that they had in that hut as well.
Obviously, thinking about Shackleton's later expedition, his transantarctic expedition, which never happened because they got stuck in the Weddell Sea and then had that whole adventure with the Endurance. Guessing from that, I feel like with Shackleton's leadership style, these men were generally close. They generally got along. They, you know, he was a charismatic leader, and I felt like I could feel that sense of charisma through the space. And like the other huts we've been to, it's really interesting how you said, Daniel, because they felt, you could feel the loss, you could feel the death, like you said. And you know, Scott's hut, that was the last place where he was. And then Cape Adair, obviously, that was a massive place of suffering for the men who were there, and also for the man who died there. But this one, that wasn't there, and I think we all really appreciated that feeling.
Mm.
What else stood out to you guys in the hut?
The food. Oh my goodness, the food stood out to me so much. Obviously, the ham that was like hanging in a bag, like on the wall. So you
didn't see that.
Yeah, so Al actually pointed out that there was like bags of food hanging up on the wall. There was like 3 bags of them. in the back right corner of the hut. So you walk in, you see the stove, walk over to the right to the little kitchen area, and on under a shelf there are three hooks, and on those hooks they had little wee bags of ham. And so whilst I was there, I had like a really good look around, and I saw a long yellow tube with red writing on it, and it had the big word mustard. And in a way, it kind of looked like a Toblerone chocolate in the best way that I can describe it. It's like a long, you know, rectangular or triangular tube that was gold slash yellow, and it had red writing, and it said mustard. And I just like wonder, what was that? Because was that liquid, or was that powder, or was it a paste? Like, I was really intrigued by that mustard and the different types of foods and sauces that I saw. That really stuck out to me.
Coleman's mustard, yeah, is a classic.
Like, Coleman's mustard, yeah. Yes.
That we used to have that at home, so it's always, whenever I see the kind of old packaging, I'm always just like, oh,
yeah. It's killer. Yeah, I really liked that.
I'd say that the thing that I really liked for this one that was kind of the setting, or the thing they laid out, was all the little trousers on the bed.
They were such
strange trousers. They're these kind of really, they're sort of full front with pockets in funny places, and like a really good, nice thick wool. And they just kind of laid them out on the beds, which made me think, you know, every time I come home, you can see right now my bed is kind of behind us, and it's currently covered in the trousers that I peeled off as soon as we got back. You know, so I really can relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really nice touch just to kind of lay them out.
I was obviously like with you, Em, and I really loved, you caught my attention when we were looking at we were standing at the top and we could see the whole penguin colony, and just, you know, there were penguins running around like little chicks chasing their mum, and, you know, this penguin doing this and this penguin doing that. But once you got fixated on one penguin, which I did, it was one little boy, and he was picking up his pebbles from one little spot, and he'd walk like 10 steps over here, he'd drop his little pebble and make his nest. He'd go back, he'd find the best looking pebble out of them all, he'd grab it and he'd go back. And that was just so cool to see, like, just a penguin being a penguin, you know, just a little Adelie penguin doing
his... He's just a little guy.
You know, just to see him being a penguin, it was cute.
This also, talking about the kind of environs, this is the first hut we've seen that really looks like it was built in the best place with the environs. Like,
yes.
The other ones, it looks like they just, like, landed and then just built wherever they landed, because it was, like, must have been crazy.
This one was a nice distance away from the penguin colony.
Yeah, it was really sheltered. It was a really picturesque spot. Yeah. Like, it was a really lovely setting there.
Yeah.
I worry about climate change a lot.
Yeah.
This was the first hut that I was like, this feels safe. And I don't know theoretically how safe it is, because there's lots of things I don't know, but Cape Adare, very low. Also, Scott's hut, like, it's real close to the seashore, and I didn't know how close it was.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing thinking about the fact that sea level rise will also affect Antarctica, which, you know, as it melts, causes sea level rise. So it's... which is a weird thing in my brain, but knowing that, you know, might affect those two huts, and that's something that conservators are probably working through that are much more intelligent than me. But this one felt safe, and it was kind of really comforting to me to see it in that spot.
It was in a good spot, eh?
Yeah, it was nice. It was kind of tucked in between a few little hills. It felt very cozy and set within that landscape with kind of Mount Erebus behind. There was a really kind of beautiful spot you could walk up.
Mount Erebus behind.
Lovely view with a little colony of Adelies there, and the kind of skuas flying about.
In the next episode, the inspiring explorers finally get to make a run for Discovery Hut at Hut Point, carrying with them the historic artifact, with hopes of returning it back to where Antarctic exploration began for both Scott and Shackleton.
This episode was written and produced by Maya Ingo, with additional writing by Louise Piggin, with technical production and music by Callum Turner, and narrated by Jake Bailey. Thanks to the donors to the Trust Inspiring Explorers Fund, expedition partner Heritage Expeditions, and supporter Cheshire Architects.